This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A stronger chorus of voices warn that we are once again at the nuclear precipice. The balance of atomic power is shifting at a moment of global discord. The heads of two nuclear countries appear to be mentally unstable. In this program, you will hear two voices about what we should and should not worry about. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. There is a new panic on the alt-right. They warn the United States could be planning a first-strike nuclear attack on Russia. Infamous radio show Alex Jones loves to cover the alleged plot, and former Reagan cabinet member Paul Craig Roberts is practically screaming about it. So should we worry about nuclear war again? I was suspicious, until I found the real data published in a well-respected bulletin of atomic scientists. The lead author is Hans M. Christensen. He is the director of the Nuclear Information Project with the Federation of American Scientists. Oxford University Press publishes his assessments as part of an annual review of global nuclear forces. Christensen is the author of two books on nuclear affairs. From Washington, Hans Christensen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
President Donald Trump promised to fund the development of new nuclear weapons, but long before he took office, according to your article, America gained a critical edge with something called the burst height compensating superfuse. What the heck is that?
Well, that's a fancy name we've given it, except for the first part, the burst height compensation fuse. It is a technology that has been in the U.S. arsenal for a while on one of the Navy's submarine warheads. But what has happened is that this increased targeting capability has also been added to a second warhead that's on the submarine. And those warheads are in far greater numbers. And so what we now have is a situation where all the warheads on all the submarines are now capable of being used against what's called the hardened targets.
And you've tracked the path towards this technology of more accurate nuclear strikes for quite a while, and it sounds to me like it may have started all the way back in the 1990s. Is that correct?
That's correct. This particular project, this particular upgrade of the latest warhead that we're describing in our article, that development started all the way back in the Clinton administration. And it was sort of, a part of an overhaul and a long-term planning where the warhead was supposed to come out and not have significantly new capabilities. But they managed to add this component to it that increases not its accuracy, but its efficiency in terms of killing targets, basically.
I know that Vladimir Putin publicly complained that America broke the balance of power based on mutually assured destruction. On July 13, 2002, the United States withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, or the ABM Treaty, which had been in force since 1972. Was ending the treaty, do you think, related to an American desire to develop more advanced nuclear capability?
No, I don't think so. I think what drove that was a dream about building a ballistic missile defense system to some extent, not for the purpose of being able to sort of have a, in the good old Reagan vision, a seal over the United States that warheads couldn't penetrate, but they wanted to have capabilities against regional adversaries and their ballistic missiles. That work has still not produced a ballistic missile defense system that is, proof certain to work after a lot of money. No, I think the issue is on the issue of the warhead upgrades. That's sort of a separate issue. That when you modernize weapons, quite often you see new technologies being built into them, and they can, in some cases, significantly enhance the capability of these warheads, just like we're seeing now with this particular warhead.
And I read through your article in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It was published March 1st, 2017. Everybody should read it. And I got the idea that this more accurate or more powerful detonation system frees up other nukes, and that could, in fact, kind of double the nuclear strength of the American arsenal. Is that an accurate picture?
Sort of. I mean, the point is that the, again, it's not the accuracy. It's the kill efficiency. And the way they do this is that The previous warhead, before it was life extended, had a fuse that had three settings. One was ground burst, the one was sort of an optimum height of burst, and the third was very high altitude. In this one, they have sort of a flexible fuse that can go off at any particular height. And so that enables the warfighters to get more warheads statistically close to the target so that they can destroy it. So what we now have is that overall, like you said, a significant increase in the overall lethality, if you will, or kill capability of the submarine force. And so, you know, some people will read into this, like the headline you quoted up first, dramatic things like that the U.S. is planning a first strike and things like that. I don't think that's the case. But it nonetheless wants to have a superior capability. And with this one, they can now free up warheads that previously were earmarked to only target these hardened targets to do more demanding tasks. So it is a way of making the remaining weapons that are in the stockpile, even though there are overall fewer of them, it is a way of making the remaining weapons more efficient so they can cover more different scenarios and be more flexible, if you will.
You added a bit of controversy by suggesting nuclear war may be a greater and more imminent threat than climate change. Is that what you think?
Let's put it in this way, that climate change is happening. It's real. It's unfolding as we speak. Nuclear war is not. We have dangers that it could if things go wrong, of course. And so it's about avoiding those dangers translating into real events. So they're two different things. But they are the two different issues that can, I'd say, unlike any other phenomenon we know of, threaten the survival of human beings. And so that is a particularly daunting task to try to avoid that these matters don't get out of hand.
And you mentioned that this fuse helps them decide where the bomb may go off in the atmosphere. And on Radio EcoShock, we've been delving into the use of nuclear weapons detonated in space to destroy electronics on the ground using an electromagnetic pulse, or EMP. Is that a completely different subject than you're covering in your bulletin article?
Yes, it is. What we're looking at is what happens when the warheads come in from space at very high speed and this cone-shaped re-entry vehicle moves toward its target. When it comes closer to the target, it has to be able to know, so to speak, at which point to go off. As like I said, in the past, they had three fixed fuses for this particular system. One would just go off when it hit the ground. One would go off when it got to a certain height. And the other one could go off in a much higher altitude, like, for example, to create the EMP effect that you mentioned. But in this case, what they've changed is that the radar on the warhead is able to read, so to speak, where it is and more accurately detonate the weapon at the optimum height of burst that is needed to create this peak pressure that destroys the target. And this is a warhead, of course, that's always been able to use against, you know, softer surface targets. But because of this new capability, it can also now go after hardened underground targets like ICBM silos that are underground and a bit hardened to withstand certain pressures from the detonating warheads. So it is an enhanced capability that has sort of been, you know, that has crept into the arsenal in a much broader scale than it used to be. And by the way, this is just the submarine force. They're also updating the fuses on the land-based ballistic missiles, the ICBM. So they will get the same capability in the future as well.
Yes, you're talking about the submarines at this time, and I'm hearing the Pentagon is working to double the range of the Tomahawk missile, and that means nuclear bombs could reach Moscow from submarines far at sea. Have you heard about that?
Submarines at sea, ballistic missile submarines, of course, can already hit all over Russia or any other country for that matter. They have very long-range ballistic missiles. The Tomahawk missiles you talk about are cruise missiles. They have a range of something in the order of, you know, 2,500 kilometers, the way it is right now. They no longer have warheads for them. They used to have nuclear warheads, but those warheads were retired. So all of those Tomahawk cruise missiles today are conventional only.
Ah, interesting. Okay. Now, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists originated the so-called doomsday clock, and in January of this year, of 2017, the clock was set at 2.5 minutes to midnight. That's the closest to catastrophe we've seen since 1953, when the Soviets detonated a hydrogen bomb. Why is it so dangerous now?
Well, so I'm not part of the board that or the group that determines whether to move forward or whatever the clock and the arms on the clock there. But my understanding is that it's a combination of factors. They not only look at nuclear issues, but they also look, of course, on climate change. And so because of these crises, and I think right now, of course, there's a deterioration of relations between the United States and NATO on the one side and then Russia on the other, and also between the U.S. and China and the South China Sea, as well as the relations with North Korea in general and their nuclear weapons programs. I think their thinking was that all of this adds up to a much more dangerous world, and therefore it was time to move the arms a little closer to midnight.
Hans Christensen, you have published a few times on new nuclear weapons tech developing in the United States. Have you been tracking the Russian response?
Yes. Well, Russia, is, for its own sake, is in the middle of its own large modernization program. All nuclear weapon states go through these phases where they upgrade their nuclear arsenals. We did ours in the United States back in the 1980s and early 90s. So we don't have to do it for a few years, but we're now beginning to plan the next cycle. And Russia started their earlier modernization before we did, and so they are now over halfway through their modernization cycle. So these cycles don't happen at the same time. So it's kind of hard to say that the modernization is a response to, direct response to. I think this has to be looked at over a long period of time. It can certainly shape their perception about what the United States is up to. And we know from Russian official statements, of course, that they're, you know, somewhat paranoid, almost certainly convinced that the United States is out to gain some type of, if not first strike, then certainly winnable military strategy and capabilities. So they're looking, from their perspective, at all these capabilities, both on the nuclear, but also on the long-range conventional precision strike, as well as ballistic missile defense systems and cyber attack and what have you. And it seems that for them, it all adds up to the United States trying to get them, so to speak. So this is one of the issues that, of course, we're pointing out here, that on the one hand, it's important if you want to have deterrence and for it to work, that it's credible. On the other hand, you have to be careful that your modernization programs don't become so good and so capable that you begin to plant doubt in the mind of an adversary about whether you're actually going to strike first. So this is a really fine balance that one has to be very careful about.
Do you think the Russians have a superfuse? And if not, can we expect them to have them soon?
I don't know if they have exactly the same technology, but they certainly have a long history of a program as well. You know, almost as old as ours in terms of ballistic missiles. And they have developed numerous types of warheads over the years for those. So they have a very advanced fuse technology, warhead technologies, just like we do. So it might be that they have something similar. I don't know, but I haven't seen it in particular. But they're certainly developing other forms of advanced reentry vehicles. For example, maneuverable reentry vehicles have been tested over the last several years. And the expectation is that the next large ballistic missile they're going to deploy, which probably at the beginning of next decade, which is called the Sarmat, that it will have an advanced payload, or some of them will have an advanced payload that can maneuver. And the motivation, at least what they're saying now, is that that is needed for them because of the U.S. building advanced ballistic missile defense systems, so their warheads have to be able to sort of fool this ballistic missile defense system. There is an arms race, not in terms of numbers, because the numbers are not going up, but there's a technological arms race on the nuclear level where the countries are quite clearly competing against each other with countermeasures and what have you.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Hans M. Christensen. He's the director of the Nuclear Information Project and a published expert on world nuclear weapons. Hans, do you think there are people in the Pentagon who might seriously argue a first strike against Russia could be, well, quotes, successful?
No, I don't think so. There are far too many uncertainties about achieving a successful first strike, certainly against a large adversary like Russia. So even though you could hypothetically develop a capability where you would have the capability to knock out all of their forces, due to sheer physics, there's no way you could ever be 100% certain that you would knock out everything. So you could not rule out some limited form of retaliation. But I also think, I really seriously doubt that in the U.S. military planning there is any interest in considering anything that looks like a surprise first strike against Russia or anything like that. That's not to say that they don't have very capable forces and offensive strike plans that can, according to those plans, do very specific type of damage against different aspects of their nuclear infrastructure and military infrastructure. But the objective here is not to create a surprise first strike or a so-called decapitating strike where they can just fire everything and then win the war.
Do you think it's possible the Trump administration could order a nuclear strike against North Korea?
If so, it would be a phenomenal mistake. But unfortunately, the President of the United States has the authority to launch such a strike if he deems it necessary. There's no requirement for him to check in with anyone else. There's no one else that has to approve it. He can wake up one day and say, now we do it. And there's no one who can legally stop him. So that's a very worrisome situation that any person, single person, should ever have such a capability. Having said that, of course, what worries me more is, I mean, it's not that he wakes up one day and suddenly decides now he has to nuke North Korea. I think the issue here is more whether his personality is a good fit for a serious crisis that requires complex thinking and strategy and patience. He doesn't seem to be really well equipped to deal with those situations. And so there is a concern, of course, that through a series of blunders, we could sort of stumble into a crisis that gets worse and escalates to nuclear use. And then in that case, you could end up in a corner where someone decided that it was necessary to use nuclear weapons. So that's more the concern I have.
Well, getting back to the larger possibility of an exchange of nuclear weapons in bigger countries, I've seen a scientific paper which analyzed the nuclear winter effect of a limited exchange of nuclear weapons between India and Pakistan.
Yes.
Surely an American first strike against Russia, as the alt-right is talking about, would boomerang into a nuclear winter that starves us all.
Oh, yeah, that's totally crazy talk. So it's like, you know, I mean, there's always been people who sort of talk about this, but I think it's important to emphasize these are not people that are representing any form of what you could call the responsible military planning that is going on. There are issues with that, and we can discuss that, of course, but we're not in this kind of cuckoo era where they're seriously contemplating that kind of stuff. So I think that's just, it's very much a fringe type of point of view that does not reflect what's actually going on.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. So do you think the United States has more nuclear escalation in development?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is the nature of all modernization programs, that they increase the capabilities. That's not just for nuclear, but also conventional. We're in this never-ending cycle. We've been in it since World War II. All countries are trying to get better at using nuclear weapons, more efficient, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is going on, and the next generation weapons will be more capable than the ones we have. And, of course, they will further fuel concerns abroad among adversaries that, you know, well, they better do something too. But again, I don't want to say that it's the United States that drives this development. All the nuclear weapon states are doing their own dirty work, so to speak. And it's just that it feeds this type of endless worst-case scenario thinking and suspicion, and it doesn't seem to stop. It just doesn't seem to stop. So I don't know how to break that cycle. But yes, we're going through the next round of modernization. It will create new capabilities, absolutely.
All right. Well, let's look at another country. I gather you've written both reports and a book on Chinese nuclear forces. Can China threaten America with nuclear weapons?
Yes, it certainly can. China has not very many, but compared to the United States and Russia, but we estimate they have something in the order of 250 to 70 nuclear warheads in their stockpile. And about probably 80 to 90 of those are on long-range ballistic missiles that can hit various parts of the United States. Some can cover the entire country, some a portion of it. And you don't need thousands of nuclear weapons to cause extraordinary destruction and damage. I mean, if just those less than 100 warheads that are on their long-range ballistic missile that can hit the United States, if they were reused, it would be the end of the United States as we know it. Just think back. The havoc and confusion and crisis that two airplanes flying in a couple of buildings in New York and one in the Pentagon, what that created in 2001. And that was nothing compared to what just one nuclear warhead will create. So that is just to emphasize here that even small arsenals have really troublesome capabilities of being able to cause enormous damage. That's why nuclear weapons are so unique and in a different category than any other kind of weapons that we know of. So yes, China can threaten the United States. And again, it's a smaller country, but again, we cannot rule out. Of course, we couldn't probably conduct a surprising first strike and be certain that all of their launchers would be destroyed. So something would probably survive and be able to be launched against us. So that's again to say that, you know, even a small arsenal can be a formidable deterrent.
Does China have a credible missile defense system?
No, they do not. Not yet, at least. But they're working on it. They're developing their own interceptors and conducting various, experiments. We do know that the American ballistic missile defense system has already had a significant impact on the way the Chinese think about their needs for how many nuclear weapons and of what kind they need for their nuclear deterrent. So what we've seen recently is that they have started deploying multiple warhead capability on their long-range ballistic missiles. So instead of just one warhead per missile, you have up to three. So that's an attempt to overwhelm or confuse, if you will, an American ballistic missile defense system. So that's already having effects there. But even though they complain about that, they themselves are already also beginning to develop ballistic missile defense systems, probably more in the sort of to give them capabilities in smaller scenarios against maybe India in those kind of scenarios. But everybody's doing something on this issue.
Well, I know that nuclear weapons development has continued with both the Democratic and the Republican parties. They all agree on it. They spend zillions of dollars to keep it going. Do you think the nuclear drive is an unstoppable social force?
It certainly seems that way. But that's not to say you can't influence it. We just have to go back a decade and sort of remember when the Obama administration came in, there definitely was a new sort of talk in town. There was definitely a new mood about prospects for, if not complete elimination, then certainly significant reductions of nuclear forces. Since then, things have changed a bit, but it still hasn't changed enough that nuclear weapons arsenals in the United States and Russia are increasing. I just want to emphasize that yes, there is a crisis and they're both modernizing, but we're still not at a point where they're building up nuclear arsenals again. So I think what's really important now with the new administration here in the United States is that this kind of loose talk we've seen on Trump's Twitter account about enhancing the numbers and capabilities of U.S. nuclear weapons, we may have to be very careful that we do not get into yet another arms race in terms of numbers here with the Russians. Fortunately, the U.S. military has been quite clear so far that they do not need more nuclear weapons. They have more than they need already, more than they need to safeguard the United States and its allies. In fact, the Pentagon has itself concluded several years ago that they could do with up to one-third fewer nuclear weapons than we have today, and they would still be able to do what they have to do. So that's just to say that there's no need to build up, there's no need to increase the arsenal.
Well, among politicians, we have heard the argument that we need new nukes, maybe tactical nukes or precision little ones or something, because nations we label rogue are becoming nuclear capable. They point to North Korea and Iran. Do you buy that?
No, not one bit. The point being here that those countries, or some of them, have been developing these capabilities for decades. that hasn't caused us to conclude that we therefore need new lower legal nuclear weapons. I think what's happening now is that we're in a crisis situation with the Russians, and that has changed the political discussion. So now it's easier for people who already wanted to have new nuclear weapons previously but couldn't quite get through in the political debate. Now they have a voice. Fortunately, I think, again, the military circumstances have not changed. There is plenty of flexible capability in the current nuclear arsenal. And the military, in a way, has really moved away from this idea that you need to have this tit-for-tat capability. It's not about, you know, exactly what kinds of weapons you have. It is what strategic effects they can bring to bear. And in this case, they say they have plenty of flexibility and different levels of use options in the current arsenal that they do not need to get new nuclear weapons.
Well, Fox News host Joe Scarborough, sort of a third-party thing, said that Trump had asked, well, what's the use of having nuclear weapons if you can't use them? That's a pretty tough question, and I'm hoping that somebody has since informed him why, but does it worry you?
It certainly worries me that the president we currently have seems to have a minuscule understanding of both nuclear weapons, even the very arsenal that he's the commander-in-chief of, but certainly also about the role of nuclear weapons, both historically, but also the role that they play today. So if you hear these statements that come out of him from once in a while, they seem to come from a different place, sort of a very simplistic mindset. When it's about nuclear weapons, I think we just have to be extraordinarily careful that the president does not sort of belittle the concern about nuclear weapons use. It is the policy of this nation that nuclear non-use has to be maintained. We have an extraordinary accomplishment that has now lasted 72 years since 1945, that we have not had use of nuclear weapons in anger anywhere in the world since those days. That is an achievement we have to hold on to and ensure that that continues, and that requires responsible behavior on the part of the President of the United States as well.
What is the Federation of American Scientists?
It's a group of scientists that started off in the nuclear weapons program back in the 1940s. They were developing the nuclear weapons, but the program was so secretive that they were not allowed to talk to each other, the scientists between the different laboratories that worked on it. So they created them what they called a Federation of Atomic Scientists, and they published a magazine. It was called the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist. That magazine still exists today as an independent magazine, and I write a column in it. But over the years, of course, the Federation of American Scientists became this arms control advocacy group, if you will, that used scientific analysis to analyze the role of nuclear weapons, monitor who's got what and where is it and what's the trend, and also come up with recommendations for how it's possible to reduce the dangers of nuclear weapons.
As we wrap up, is there any take-home message you would like to leave in the minds of our listeners?
I would just urge that when people read the newspapers, that they don't get swept away in this sort of the feeling of crisis, and the Russians are coming, the Chinese are coming, the North Koreans are coming, and sort of forget and leap into quick decisions about increasing the role of nuclear weapons or building more of them, etc. I think it's important that we try to stay the course and reduce the role of nuclear weapons, of course, not just in our own strategy, but also try to influence how other nuclear weapons states see the role of, and their requirements for nuclear weapons.
We've been talking with Hans M. Christensen under the umbrella of the Federation of the American Scientists. Hans directs the Nuclear Information Project, and we've been talking about a new article published in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. You can find the Atomic Scientists at thebulletin.org. The title of this provoking article is How the U.S. Nuclear Force Modernization is Undermining Strategic Stability, the Burst Height Compensating Superviews, with co-authors Matthew McKinsey and Theodore A. Postol. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Hans, thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Is America out to defeat Russia? Why? Is Russia that rich? Is America that broke? Why did Russia help Donald Trump get elected, if they did? Who is pushing stories of nuclear war and profiting from public fear? I've got so many questions, and I have my suspicions, but it is hard to know. Looking for answers, or at least some clues, I phoned Greg Mello for a conversation. He trained as an engineer and planner. In 1989, Greg co-founded a nonprofit called Los Alamos Study Group. He's still the executive director. Greg researches and writes about global security. His articles have appeared in The Washington Post, The New York Times, and more. From Albuquerque, New Mexico, Greg Mello, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. Great to be here.
We live in astounding times, with the President of the United States engaging in some very risky behavior, and he's got the nuclear launch codes. Greg, what could go wrong?
Oh, a lot of things could go wrong. I guess I may be in a minority, but I don't think that he's very much more dangerous than the more rational, coldly calculating people who think that they can control the world. And then that type of person can easily back themselves into a, and the country and the world, into a corner.
Well, I sort of know what you're talking about. There was the whole direction that several presidents have taken that America should control everything. But there was at least sort of a series of procedures and understandings that you would think would precede any decision to launch nuclear weapons. But now it looks like it could be done even on an impulse if he's got that much power.
Yes, we had a discussion about that in some of us around here the other day, and we're not sure that the public narrative about that is 1,000% accurate. And it would have to be stated that he had the complete power to launch a nuclear strike on moment's notice, but it might actually be a little different. Someone who worked in the Pentagon under Nixon, toward the end, there was someone staying in the Secretary of Defense's office, or else it was the operations room of the Pentagon, to intercept a potential call from Nixon about a nuclear strike to make sure it didn't happen.
Well, that would be a comforting thought, I think. All right, but look, Greg, the mother of all bombs was tested in Afghanistan, complete with a official government video so we could all admire the gigantic explosion. And it seems like a small step from there to venture a tactical nuclear weapon on North Korea or even a complete attempt at debilitating them with the first strike. Would you be surprised if that happened?
Oh, I'd be very surprised. It has been discussed before and is, you know, discussed from time to time. I recall the first time being in Senator Domenici's office in Washington. His staff member had just returned from the Pentagon where they had gotten a briefing on nuking North Korea. Believe it or not, Wagner's Götterdämmerung was playing in the background, and the man, the gentleman, the staff member, whose name I don't need to mention, asked me what I thought. You could see him, the wheels churning. He said, I've got an actual peace activist here in my office. Maybe I'll ask him, see what response I can get about nuking North Korea. So he did ask me. He asked me what I thought about that. So, you know, it's always in the background. Scenarios are worked out. But the analysis of Lee Butler from many years ago still stands, that if the United States should use a nuclear weapon, it would immediately martyr the enemy, empower terrorists and other would-be enemies, unleash a race for proliferation. And I think that pretty much all those things are well understood around the federal government.
Well, now, when it comes to Russia, I'm not a fan of Russian autocracy, and I'm wary of Russian organized crime, but I can't help notice that American actions to threaten Russia are ongoing by putting troops into Estonia, missiles into countries on the Russian border like Poland and Romania. Am I just imagining that the United States is encircling Russia militarily?
No, Alex, I don't think you are. And this has us really scared because it's so deep and structural and it's so pervasive, and it's very difficult to get any contrary narratives into the U.S. press and in Washington, when you talk to some people, once I tried to talk to someone in the National Security Council about how foolish all of this was, and I got a tirades about evil Russia, and it's really, I think it's very scary, and you know, I can't say enough bad about it. It's completely unnecessary and counterproductive to U.S. security.
And what I don't get is, like, the Soviet Union gave up, and Russia attempted a form of capitalism, sort of, and why hasn't the United States given up the dream of war with Russia?
Well, it serves so many interests. I tried to make a little list of the reasons while we were waiting to come on the air, and you know, here's some of them. The military-industrial complex needs money. I think you alluded to that already. And not just money, but the U.S. deep state gains power in this way and consolidates and continues its power. I think we're seeing now also the use of hating or fearing Russia as a way of unifying the country politically and creating an opposition to the Trump administration, which I would say, you know, there's all kinds of reasons to be concerned about the Trump administration and to oppose it, but not Russia. So let's see, why Russia? Well, Russia is a big country. It's a nuclear peer or near peer. It could really destroy the United States completely with just a fraction of its nuclear arsenal. It has a tremendous resource base, it has a central location, and highly advanced science, engineering, technology, and a unified, pretty unified politically. So there's a lot of reasons to be, if you wanted to pick a country to generate fear and hate toward, Russia would be ideal. There's also the deeper reasons. Its geographic location, its geopolitical importance. Much of the Cold War occurred because we didn't want Russia and Europe to be unified, especially Germany. So now we have really a decisive fraction of Europe's natural gas coming from Russia, and that will continue. There's a real struggle over the energy basis of Europe and how much of that Russia will control. Other than Qatari gas, there's no big alternative to Iranian and Russian gas in reverse order of importance. So it goes really all the way back to the 19th century and the early 20th century. We could mention the British geographer Halford Mackinder, who noted that, and I think his theory of what's it called geographic pivot of history, that whoever controls Eastern Europe commands the heartland, as he called it, and whoever commands the heartland can control the world. And that is really the enduring thrust of U.S. policy toward Russia. It has been for decades, and it's basically an inherited strategy from the British Great Game. And it's, you know, written into official documents as recently as 2015 in the National Military Strategy of the U.S. It was in the Bush-era documents. It was in 1992, Wolfowitz's draft guidance, what was it called, draft guidance for post-war, see the formal name of it here is slipping my mind. But the idea is that no peer competitor of the United States should be allowed to arise. And Russia is the Russia and China are the two possible peer competitors. Oh, yeah, that was Wolfowitz document was called the Draft Defense Planning Guidance. You can Google it online. It was leaked, and it was the quote here is from Wolfowitz, "Our first objective is to prevent the reemergence of a new rival." Remember, this was right after the end of the Cold War. "This is a dominant consideration underlying the new regional defense strategy and requires that we endeavor to prevent any hostile power from dominating a region whose resources would, under consolidated control, be sufficient to generate global power. These regions include Western Europe, East Asia, the territory of the former Soviet Union, and Southwest Asia." So Russia is the preeminent geographic concern of people who think this way, and which is pretty much at this point, most of the empowered U.S. foreign policy establishment.
In a way, you've made me feel better and worse because, in a sense, it isn't that Donald Trump is the guy who's, well, he's going to push more spending on the U.S. atomic arsenal and more military spending, but that's just part of a long, long trend of strategy that you've just outlined. Trump's just the new guy who's getting tuned into the old story.
That sounds exactly right. And where he goes off message and tries to make peace with Russia, then he's attacked. As soon as he launches 59 cruise missiles and drops the mother of all bombs, then he is praised by the neoconservatives for acting presidentially.
It's amazing. That is how it works. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Greg Mello from the Los Alamos Study Group. Did you write that the recent increase in U.S. military spending is bigger than the entire Russian military budget?
I think I wrote that it's almost as big, and I'm not sure that I am a great enough expert on how these dollar figures translate over into Russia, but it's very close to the same amount. So it's shocking, really.
I want to float an idea by you, Greg. Just give me a second. At the Munich Security Conference in 2007, talking about the development of American nuclear superiority, possibly, Vladimir Putin said, quote, "We will respond accordingly, but how? We can match you in your actions and build an equally great multi-million-dollar anti-missile defense system, or, taking into account our economics and financial capability in the current day, we can respond asymmetrically," end quote. Now, I suggest that nuclear worry is one force driving the Russians to interfere in American elections. They've got to get people who aren't following that line of trying to take them over. And so this election idea is kind of an asymmetrical response that maybe a chess player like Putin would consider. What do you think?
Well, Alex, I don't think there's any proof that the Russians interfered with the election. I haven't read the book, but this new, just to pick the latest, one of the latest additions to this discussion, that book Shattered, which is about the Clinton campaign, has a passage that within 24 hours after the election, John Podesta and Robbie Mook decided that they were going to stress the Russian angle. And I think that is all part of the demonization of Russia. But your original point about the asymmetric response is, quoting Putin, they have, in the 10 years since then, they have developed and I think now beginning to deploy maneuvering warheads, even missiles, which in their boost phase can change direction. And it's much cheaper for them to develop better missiles than to try to make an anti-ballistic missile system. Ours doesn't really work, probably never work, and it's a good way to transfer money to contractors. But to the extent that they have their fantasies about technology just like we do. To the extent that they believe it and their military-industrial complex seizes upon it, they will simply develop more powerful offensive weapons, probably for 10 or 20 cents on the dollar we spent on ineffective ABM systems.
Following some really outrageous claims by Alex Jones and by others, I'm asking this question of a couple of people. Do you believe there is any serious person in the Pentagon or the administration who would consider a first strike nuclear attack on Russia?
I do not believe that any person would do so. I think there are moral considerations, and not everyone would agree with me there, but not everyone is a complete sociopath. It takes coordination of a lot of people to do anything like that. And so there'd be ethical people who would do the right thing and make it difficult to set that up. But apart from that, Russia has road mobile, rail mobile systems, and the submarines, while we may be able to find most of them before they could launch their missiles, although I don't know that, I think that would be the most optimistic case. The idea that one could sink every single Russian submarine with ballistic missiles as a prelude to a first strike by the U.S., I don't think that's possible. So if even 5% of the Russian nuclear force struck the U.S., it would completely obliterate the United States. So, you know, it's just a—I think it's a, not likely.
It's suicidal is what it is.
Yes. The threat of nuclear war is used— has lots of uses, and indeed it's very scary. I mean, for real reasons. Don't think that I'm not afraid of nuclear war by miscalculation, or that some president or some successor to Putin in Russia could do terrible things. And plus Russia has got in addition to what I mentioned before, they have a so-called dead hand system they call Perimeter that has multiple sensors. But if nuclear detonations start occurring on Russian soil, then rockets go up with the launch command. And it's a fairly automated system, and not completely. But they put that there because of the possibility of a disarming first strike. And so it's, you know, it goes right back, not quite the doomsday machine of Dr. Strangelove, but it's very serious stuff. And I don't think that anybody would be crazy enough to do that. What people might be crazy enough to do is to think that they could launch a regional, like a tactical nuclear weapon in a regional war, or to protect a surrounded pocket of U.S. soldiers, or in retaliation for China sinking, or even North Korea sinking aircraft carrier or something like that. There might be popular pressure, that sort of thing. And then that could, it would be bad enough in itself, but it could also spiral out of hand quickly.
You know, for difficult things, Greg, humans tend to rely on their only experience, whatever it is. And for nuclear bombs, that means Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Both those cities rebuilt. They're quite vibrant today. Why is it different now?
That's a terrific question. Those were small nuclear bombs, and their effects were relatively localized, both in terms of the thermal effects, the blast effects, the fallout, and the, what the British would say, the knock-on effects across society. I personally believe that one thermonuclear bomb would be enough to knock out the United States as a united, functioning society. Modern society is a lot more fragile than people think. That's the other change. The skills, the just-in-time delivery of goods, supply chains, manufacturing, the nodes of energy, both fossil fuel and electrical, all these are very delicate. But going back to the direct effects, a large thermonuclear weapon will burn down a large city and create a hellstorm of fire, and no one can survive. It's like Dresden times 1,000. And then there's the fallout, so if, say, a ground bursts over there, even at the ICBM fields in Wyoming or wherever, those threaten fatal fallout in the U.S. Midwest, you know, hundreds of miles away. So it's quite different.
It's so hard to imagine a full nuclear war, and we can't. I mean, in my mind, the only comparison is the asteroid that hit the Earth about 65 million years ago. Scientists believe the sun was blotted out by the dust. Most species shivered and died. That's not too drastic for a nuclear exchange between America and Russia. And I think it's important to say, too, that the forecast of nuclear winter after the use of nuclear weapons, it's not just an idea made up by peaceniks or environmentalists. It's based on real science from physicists, people who know the field. Isn't that true?
Yes, it is. I'm really glad you brought that up. I'm sorry I forgot to say it. Yeah, that's, you know, everything burns. When everything burns, like I'm looking out at a asphalt street right now, that would burn. And millions of tons of black soot would be carried up by the winds of these storms. So, you know, a big thermonuclear bomb creates a giant hot bubble in the atmosphere, like maybe a mile across. And that thing rises up at, say, 300 miles an hour, sucks everything up. It goes right up through the top of the troposphere, that firestorm that follows also goes right on through, and that black soot would hang out above all the weather where the sun in the daytime would hit those black particles and re-loft them. So whatever natural settling takes place would be counteracted by the permanent sunshine up there. And so they stay up there for a really long time and blocking the sun and preventing food crops, making it really cold for a really long time, and it would be extremely hard for most life to exist. And the only question in this whole analysis is, where are the nuclear bombs targeted to create the initial cloud of soot? I mean, if they are in flat, farmland, there's not that much to burn. But if they are in cities, then there is a lot to burn.
And I'm wondering, if the worst happened and there was a nuclear war between the United States and Russia, would my listeners in New Zealand and Australia survive all right?
Well, you can go to nuclearddarkness.org, a great website produced by Steve Starr, and read about these effects in detail. And he's got some animated pictures there of different nuclear war scenarios. It takes a while, but the low temperatures go down into the southern hemisphere as well. There's mixing in the atmosphere, as you would expect. And it doesn't take a lot to curtail the growing season. So, you know, if you're in New Zealand and you experience, say, a 3 or 5 degrees centigrade temperature drop, you can't really grow anything. And you can't be resupplied from anywhere in these scenarios because there's no resupply. So it's universal.
I want to go back to one thing that you touched on, and that is the president's ability to order a nuclear strike. And, you know, my fear, and I think it's shared by a lot of other people, is could the Donald do it one grumpy night at 3 a.m. at the time he's tweeting, unopposed and unchecked? But I'm hopeful that, as you said, there's some sort of machinery where they could say, well, Mr. President, our equipment isn't ready or something, to stop that from happening.
Yes. That speculation on my part is a kind of a judgment. I think the right answer for me is I just don't know. I'm skeptical of the claims. We've heard talks by U.S. senior officials that, you know, this is how it works. Well, then you ask a few questions, and I'm not sure it is so simple that it works the way that they say. But on the other hand, I don't know how it works. So, and I think we'll never know how it works.
They don't want you to know how it works.
Right.
Okay. Now, it sounds to me like the nuclear weapons game is almost like a kind of gangsterism that we perform on ourselves. The whole world is held hostage to it. Is there any way out?
Yes. The first things that we need to do is start talking. And, you know, you'll see a pattern in the press coverage here in this Russiagate scandal or drama, soap opera, or whatever you want to call it, where, you know, Michael Flynn talked to the Russian ambassador. Oh, my God, they're talking. Well, what, you know, that's what ambassadors are for. That incoming administration needs to talk to people. Okay, so we talk. We need to talk. And that can be done through many channels in many ways, and it ought to happen. We need to be standing down some of our forces that I think anything that creates greater confidence. Right now, there's a ready to start again at the UN. There are negotiations to ban nuclear weapons. Now, those are opposed by both the U.S. and Russia. And we ought to just let those proceed and take the fallout, which will, you know, the nuclear establishment is where the fallout is going to come to. We can stop modernizing excessively, start cutting back, and if we've got channels open, the Russians may do the same. And right now, the U.S. and Russia have 93% of the world's intact nuclear weapons. So really, this is still, and if you include NATO countries, that makes 96%. So the nuclear weapons problem is not exclusively a NATO versus Russia problem, but it is importantly a NATO versus U.S. problem. We can move our, you brought up the forward positioning of troops and their armored divisions. And in fact, NATO made sure that they were Germans. So we put German armored divisions on Russia's border, which never happened since World War II. And it's all done quite consciously. You know, there was a congressional staff member, a neocon. I heard about this from another staff member. He spoke at a conference in Paris. He said, let's move nuclear weapons to border Russia, and because that would really tick them off. And so that is an attitude which is in the U.S. government and in key places. And we need to establish the opposite attitude. Why would it be in our interest to tick off the Russians? Well, because as you said in the beginning, we want to dismantle the Russian state. We want to weaken or dismantle it because of these long-term considerations. And even Henry Kissinger has said that the policy of the Obama administration is one of breaking Russia. Well, that's just the wrong attitude. It'll never work. And if we dismantle that attitude and realize that the other guy's security is also our security, then we can get that vector going in the good direction. Then we can refocus some of our efforts in building the country that is kind of run down and taking care of our terrible climate problem.
Well, I'm enjoying this conversation, and I'm sorry to say we are running out of time. How do people find the Los Alamos Study Group?
We're on the web at lasg.org for Los Alamos Study Group.
I urge people to check it out. Greg Mello, thank you for stopping by.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Greg Mello is the executive director of the nonprofit group Los Alamos Study Group. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock. The other day I was standing in a field by the river amid a chorus of river birds. Looking down, there was a perfect sample of the living world. A swirl of plants filled every space with insects treading about, seen above and unseen below the soil. It all continued without any need for humans, and will continue unless we manage to destroy it. I dedicate this radio project to them and remind you that love is the reason we confront these dark things within. I know most of the world is distracted by the greatest show on earth, the current drama of madness and corruption in Washington and many other capitals. When a bolt of lightning tears us away from everything, we call it thunderstruck. Now we are Trumpstruck, as the world's new global media system feeds us a soap opera of a lifetime. I have to remind myself, there's a radio show to make, a dinner to make, a garden to plant. I have to remind myself that the clock is ticking for the timeless natural world we love. Our emissions change the atmosphere more daily. More guns are sold, more plastic fills the oceans, and less time remains to wake up from the manufactured dream. So a special thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock again this week.